Thanks for listening to the Frontiers podcast. If you have a moment before we start, please rate and follow this podcast. It makes a huge difference. The more of you that do this, the more people get to listen. And the more people that get to listen, the bigger platform I'm building for academics to share their research. Thanks so much. Hi there. You're listening to Frontiers, the podcast that explores cutting-edge research from the world's best scientists. I'm Ian Hallett, and in each episode, I interview professors, doctors, and research scientists who are leading authorities in technology, economics, business, politics, the environment, and sociology, so we can learn about the scientific breakthroughs that will redefine our world. Today, I'm delighted to share my conversation with Professor Alison Taylor. Professor Taylor is a clinical associate professor at NYU Stern School of Business and executive director of Ethical Systems. Alison is an expert in risk, anti-corruption, sustainability, human rights, ESG, ethics, and compliance. Our conversation is off the back of Alison's book, Higher Ground, which is getting great momentum in all sorts of different audiences. And we start off with the big question in that book, which is, what does it mean to be a good business? And the answer is multifaceted, very, very complicated, and very, very interesting. We also talk into what has driven this change of perspective and why it's important. We then go on to the role of CEOs and leaders and ask them what they need to do differently to make the shift and how we know whether it's happening. And what does it mean for the type of person that should be leading businesses in the future? It's a really fascinating conversation. I really hope you enjoy it. So I'm going to hand you over now to Professor Alison Taylor. Professor Taylor, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your book, Higher Ground, seems to have a lot of momentum. So let's start with the main themes that you're talking about there. So what does it mean to be a good business?
Well, that's the million, possibly trillion dollar question. I wrote the book because I would argue that we have, one, completely lost sight of this question. Or maybe a better way to put this is we're having this conversation. We're having a very high stakes debate about what the role of business in society should be. We're having that conversation via a lot of impenetrable jargon. You might know terms like ESG and sustainability and purpose. Nobody seems to like the word ethics these days. I think that's a very interesting, one of the interesting findings from the many interviews I did was how many ethics experts told me they try and avoid using the word ethics. And then another interesting thing is that people advocating for many of these ideas are very, very keen to deny that their ideas have anything to do with ethics or anything to do with normative questions. There's a tendency to equate ethics with ideology and say, oh, well, we're not ideological. This is just good capitalism. And so my argument would be that we need to have this conversation. Everybody is having this conversation via other rhetorical vehicles. And then also that we have lost sight of these questions because of the way corporate action and corporate structures and corporate decision-making and attitudes to these questions have evolved. So my immodest goal was to try and cut through this jargon and at least provide some clarity about what we're talking about and some advice on what I think companies most often get wrong.
And where did the question come from?
The question came from my career experience, broadly speaking. So in my 20s, I had editorial jobs. I worked in mainstream management consulting, and then I worked in what used to be called political risk consulting. So looking at where companies operated, you know, should you go into this market and what might be the political and economic challenges? Then I spent 12 years in what is often called corporate investigation. So investigating corruption and fraud and doing anti-bribery due diligence, first in the Middle East and Africa and then in the Americas. And so that work was ethics and compliance teams and general counsels and law firms and risk and very high priority and very, very secretive. Then I studied organizational psychology and then I moved into sustainability and went to work for a big nonprofit. And so that move from dealing with lawyers and risk and serious topics and litigation to this world of human rights and climate change and purpose and corporate citizenship was like an Alice through the looking glass moment. I found this completely new world, a new set of jargon, and I became fascinated by these disconnects. I became fascinated by how these ideas did and didn't talk to each other and all the questions that we were all collectively trying to avoid. So It's a lot of this comes from my real world experience of working in these various aspects of corporate ethics and integrity, and looking at what worked and what didn't, and then feeling like we needed to kind of take the conversation up a level and provide a broad spectrum view, rather than something that's very, very deeply and wonkily in one of these worlds with all the technicalities and impenetrability that goes along with that.
So could you share that broad view that you have developed through your research, through the interviews you've done, through the research that you've done?
I could at some length, but I think the conclusions are that corporations need to base their ethical commitments on their impact on human beings. By extension, business and human rights frameworks, while far from perfect and far from uncontroversial, offer the best guidance to navigate this, partly because they explicitly consider the role of the government. That corporations need to do something about internal misalignment. There are many examples of this, but one of the most obvious is companies making very PR-led sustainability commitments and setting goals while their government relations team is in the background doing something completely different. I think clean up your own mess before you go out there and start yodeling about trying to save the world. And then I think focus and stop over-promising, focus on problems that you can actually solve and be more restrained and realistic about the limits of what you can achieve in a for-profit corporation.
So if you are a CEO of a massive organization with these, there's two pressures that don't always seem to connect. I can see a convergent happening, but I'm struggling to understand how they would call prioritization of certain issues. So they have their main objective, I would say, is to increase shareholder value. And you have other objectives around, and we can use all the jargon we like, sustainability, ESG, ethics, doing the right thing, being a good business, and so are those things, which aren't necessarily in conflict with shareholder value. In fact, they shouldn't be in conflict with shareholder value, but they might be in the short term. And it might require a allocation of capital, allocation resources that's fundamentally different to the way that the organization is set up currently. So how would a CEO navigate that tension with those different things? Or do you not see a tension in the way that I've just characterized it?
No, I think there's a massive tension. So you've just asserted that organizations' fundamental purpose is to protect shareholder value. The markets certainly still behave that way. Certainly those pressures exist. That said, good luck attracting any young workers or consumers if you go out there and say, the only thing I care about is shareholder value. So what we have at the moment, I would call a sort of everything, everywhere, all at once problem, where those short-term shareholder value pressures haven't gone away, but there's now a new cacophony of voices and cacophony of pressures. And most global corporations have sort of sleepwalked into this rhetoric of we care about stakeholders and we balance the interests of our stakeholders and we create value for all our stakeholders. That was driven by Larry Fink. It was driven by the Business Roundtable. It's been driven by a lot of very convenient rhetoric. It has been driven by a lot of PR firms saying, if any of your stakeholders care about this thing, you need to have an initiative about it. And it has driven grandiosity and overpromising and a lot of frankly generic, weird rhetoric about purpose and stakeholder engagement. The typical result of all this is everywhere to be seen. But what it typically results in is a lot of kind of glossy brochureware full of smiling women in hard hats and smiling children in developing countries, giant laundry lists of issues and giant laundry lists of all the wonderful things we're doing. And essentially treating these topics as stealth PR, because as you've asserted, the underlying goal is still protecting shareholder value. And corporate law, in fact, argues that stakeholders are fundamentally antithetical to the value of a corporation, and therefore we need to protect corporate value from those stakeholder perceptions. So part of the problem, I think, is that we've moved towards this sustainability and stakeholder rhetoric, but our underlying assumptions of our legal system and our financial system are still the same as they ever were. So we now have this unconvincing rhetoric pasted on to a business model that we've had all along. So what we need to do is to stop treating all this stuff as the paramilitary wing of the marketing department take a few issues seriously that are directly relevant to your business model and how you make money. Treat those as strategic priorities. So exactly as you say, that means you need senior leaders, you need incentives, you need capital allocation decisions, you need a focus, you need to say, here's what I am not going to tackle. And you need to be clear and honest and restrained about that. You will still have a bunch of issues related to your culture and people. You will still have issues related to social identity and diversity and inclusion and culture and psychological safety and a burnout and remote work. If you employ people, you can't say those things have got nothing to do with your business. But on environmental and social topics, I think everybody would benefit enormously from a lot more focus and a lot more restraint.
Do you think there's a number of rating agencies out there like MSCI and Sustainalytics and these types of bodies that use the data from annual reports and questionnaires that these companies fill out to help give an assessment as to how good they are across many of the dimensions that we've been talking about so far? And I learned recently, actually, that because obviously the company I work for, we go through this process, that the goalposts change every year, so it gets tougher. It's essentially a relative rating system. So the expectations are increasing year to year. So it seems like there's a tool driven by investors to get senior leaders of listed organizations to pay attention to these things because these ratings make a difference in the end. That's the theory, I guess. Is there any, what do you think about that as a concept, as a tool, as a forcing mechanism to get this on the agenda?
Well, there's a lot going on here. I don't know if you've ever spent any time on the kind of original source material, which is SASB and GRI, and looked at the metrics and looked at the thinking. So one, there's a philosophical conflict about what these ratings are supposed to measure. Should we focus on risk to the company and investor returns, or should we focus on the impact of the company? Massive tensions between the EU and the US on that right this moment. Two, yes, these are tools designed for investors. So we are telling companies, you need to disclose these million data points. Investors are going to use those data points to evaluate your non-financial performance, correlate it with financial performance, score you, and allocate capital accordingly. And then we are somehow surprised that organizations try to spin that data in the most positive and appealing way possible. Then we've got the ratings agencies, the MSCIs and so on, who are doing a couple of problematic things. One is that they are now pitching companies on, you know, pay me and I'll tell you how to get a better rating. Two, they are boiling down these enormous list of highly complex issues. And if you look at the underlying data, you will see this into a single score. So then you get people like Elon Musk kind of out there ranting because Tesla has a lower ESG score than Exxon, which is a complete misunderstanding of how these ratings are used. And this kind of gets me back to the original point, which is this is one of the vehicles by which we're having a problematic conversation about the role of business in society. More broadly, I think there's this sort of fantasy, maybe that's a little strong, there is a fantasy that we move from transparency to accountability. So we have this idea that if we can just get people to disclose, then somehow, not just investors, but you and I will somehow be able to hold companies accountable and move our dollars and move our consumer choices and move our job choices to away from the bad companies and towards the good companies. That's super problematic because no one has that focus. We're all trapped in the supermarket wondering what kind of coffee to buy. And we don't have the attention. And corporate disclosures are getting far more complicated, even when companies aren't deliberately obfuscating. And we've got stuck at the disclosure stage. We've been arguing for at least 25 years about what companies should be disclosing on climate. We've never actually moved to the point where we are asking them to do anything. So I think we're also telling ourselves that transparency is somehow going to magically lead to accountability. And I'm certainly not saying transparency is bad, but there's very limited evidence that that's happening.
So how do you get the accountability?
I think that's a really, really big and problematic question. The whole existence of these topics is arguably the result of regulatory failures. I do think we need to just be more honest with companies and have a better and more honest and restrained discourse. I think There are plenty of people working in companies that would like to run more ethical and effective businesses. They just don't know how because they're absolutely drowning in bad advice. And so I don't think it's ridiculous to say if you wanted to run an ethical business today that does not fall prey to some of these misunderstandings, what would you do? I'm certainly not saying corporate voluntary action is going to solve anything. And that's why one of my big pieces of advice is business needs to get out of the political process.
So this is going to sound like an incredibly basic question.
Sure.
But sometimes you get good answers or interesting answers from the most basic questions, which is, why is this important? Why is this topic, this conversation important?
Because we for a long time, treated the Milton Friedman Doctrine as a religion. Just focus on shareholder value and don't break the law. That, as you know, is from an article in 1970 where, number one, capitalism was the US, some of Europe and Japan. And number two, there was a very different view about the role of business in society. And the government worked a lot better and legal mechanisms worked a lot better. So since then, we have had companies globalize to try to avoid legal oversight. And we've had the spread of capitalism. We've had the kind of, this globalization. We used to say in the 90s, it's going to be the end of history. We've had social media. We've had the rise of transparency. We've had the rise of political turmoil. We've had enormous value shifts. And so we are still kind of arguing about this using old tropes that don't work anymore. ESG, I think, emerged initially as a response to regulatory failures. But more recently, a bunch of voices, including people like Tarek Fancy, have popped up and said, well, ESG will never work. We need to regulate, not understanding that this whole concept comes from failures of regulation. So I think this is important because we have descended into misinformation about what problems businesses can and can't solve. We are providing businesses with glib solutions that don't really exist. There are a lot of fiendishly difficult questions below the surface on how far companies should go in trying to solve these issues. We're not even having those conversations because we're too busy yelling at each other about whether ESG drives better financial returns.
You talked about fiendishly hard questions. What are the most fiendishly hard questions that you have come across or think are important that people should be addressing?
There are many, but let's take a very obvious example. We used to have this idea again in the 90s, early 2000s. Business will go into countries like China and Russia. There will be economic liberalization and then there'll be political liberalization. And China and Russia will become democracies and capital and the end of history. And we're all heading to this sunny future where everybody is self-actualized and living in a democracy. Well, how's that going? So I think part of the problem is, you know, if we're saying, for example, as we're saying in the EU, Western companies need to pull out of China on human rights grounds, is that good for human rights in China? If we don't say that capital is going to lead to economic and political liberalization, what questions does that raise about for a cocoa company operating in West Africa, who has been trying to tackle deforestation and child labor for 25 years, it isn't getting any better. Lots of those companies are, you know, building schools and have all these initiatives, doesn't seem to be working. To what degree are they undermining the government? To what degree is that their responsibility? We don't seem to know. We don't have a good idea of answers to any of these questions. And I certainly wouldn't claim to have the answers. I would just suggest we need to have a better conversation.
We do need to have a better conversation. It is very, very confusing.
Yeah.
This whole topic is very confusing, which I think is part of the argument that you're making, which is it's so confusing, we need to start talking about it to unconfuse it.
I think there's just a lot of people are kind of spraying a lot of confusion into the gears, not necessarily deliberately, but I think there is, I just find the vast majority of what I read and listen to about this just doesn't get to the point. So there's a lot of a lot of rhetoric sort of saying the distinction between shareholders and stakeholders is a false dichotomy. Everything's a win-win. You can have your cake and eat it. Doing the right thing for stakeholders will be the right thing for shareholders in the end. Well, sorry, it's all a bit more complicated than that. or you have a chorus of voices saying business just needs to go back to basics and focus on Milton Friedman. Don't think you can do that. You've got a lot of generational tensions in the workforce. You've got very different ideas about leadership emerging. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
There is. So what should the role of a business be then? So if it's not to create, it's not singularly to create shareholder value, which is the design of, well, certainly private or listed organizations that are there for a profit. What is their role?
The role is to create some valuable product or service that people want to buy, and then make your best good faith effort to clean up your negative externalities and any mess that you make in the process, to provide people with work and products and services. In the process, hopefully you generate shareholder value. But saying businesses exist to generate shareholder value is like saying a human being exists to be a vehicle for a beating heart. I mean, yes, it's technically true. That is not why any of us get out of bed in the morning.
So if you're an organization that is in an industry that has a product, or, well, let's say a product, because I'm like less likely to be a service, a product that has significant external effects, you could say in the oil industry or construction or these types of things that create damage as a result of the product that is needed and wanted by the consumer. How would you deal with that? How would you deal with that issue of, I'm providing a service, I'm providing a product to a market that needs it. There are consequences to that. What do I do about those consequences? How do I focus on the cleanup?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to acknowledge is that that's true of 100% of businesses. We have a tendency to say, right, oil industry bad, needs to go away, renewable industry better. The renewable energy industry also creates a ton of negative externalities. It's conflict minerals. Solar panels come from Xinjiang. Lots of labor rights issues, lots of recycling issues. So the first thing we need to do is get beyond rhetoric about there's good companies and bad companies, and companies with purpose only do good things and companies without purpose do bad things. We need to be realistic that the way that our economic system is designed means that all companies are hopefully having some good effect. They are all having a bad effect as well. Then companies need to make a good faith effort to manage their most pressing negative impacts that are most core to how they make money. And I think the ESG and sustainability industry has largely become an exercise in hand waving to detract attention from those things. So I'm certainly not saying that that's easy. I mean, arguably, again, if regulation was working better, we wouldn't need any of these efforts. But, I think if a corporation is making its best possible effort to do no harm and then not trying to put its thumb on the scale to avoid regulation that would be good for everybody, that is at least a start.
So you talked earlier about the types of things that businesses need to do to make this transition. How do we therefore know whether they're being successful or not?
I don't know that we are going to know. I mean, one of the interesting things is that companies have a wildly different reaction on wildly different reaction on social media for the same behavior. One of the most promising ways we can hold companies accountable today is via employees. I think young employees care deeply about these topics. They're inside the building. There is a massive new trend about employees finding and weaponizing damaging internal information onto social media. So, I think companies need to understand everything that they say or do may become public knowledge. And I think companies need to put in place mechanisms so that there's a sort of obsession with hypocrisy. You end up looking like a hypocrite just because you don't have the right internal governance and coordination and you're not clear about what you are and aren't claiming to do. And I think there needs to, broadly speaking, be a lot more consultation and listening to employees and treating ethics and treating culture as a collective decision-making effort, which is not the same thing as saying I'm a corporate leader, I'm like a democracy and you are like the electorate. So I think that's the paradox.
Okay, let's shift to the role of the chief executive of these organizations. What type of person do we need? running these organizations in order to lead the change that you're advocating that organizations need to embark on?
I think most of all, what we need is people that understand that nobody, no matter how personally impressive, should make decisions in isolation. I would argue we have a very schizophrenic notion of leadership today. If you look at CEO job descriptions, at least in the US, they have significantly shifted over the last 15 years. So we are looking now for not so much for technical skills, not so much for financial skills. We're looking for more international backgrounds, facility and confidence with topics like sustainability and diversity, social skills, networking skills, influence skills. We can see in Silicon Valley, we've gone from this sort of maybe partly era of giant egotists to these kind of more quiet, considerate, influential leaders. At the same time, we're still out there valorizing Elon Musk and Mark Andreessen and all these kind of big egos. So I think we also are in an era of crisis and we like these rather authoritarian figures in many, many ways. So I think maybe rather than thinking about how do we make CEOs be more ethical or how do we select more ethical leaders, and that's a big issue, who we hire and promote and what behavior we reward is a huge issue. But I think the bigger issue is to try to create collective decision-making efforts that can correct for those checks and correct for those blind spots at the top.
And this is a big shift. So we think about the typical CEO that would be running a company even 10 years ago and the profile that we were looking for. And now the profile that you just described today, which has different elements to it. Is it, in terms of the nature of the individual, a significant change? Are people that are currently CEOs capable of making this shift? I'm trying to understand how big it is for people.
I tend to hear a lot in the classroom that we just need to wait for the current generation of leaders to die off and have a new generation of millennials kind of coming through. And some days I feel like that. I do think we've got a problem with entrenched thinking at the top. I do think there's somewhat of a reluctance to kind of see the writing on the wall. So this is another reason to gather the perspective of younger employees who are often far more informed and far more passionate about these topics. That said, you could learn, you could evolve. You just, I think, would need to honestly want to. So, you know, we've still got a problem in most countries in the world, which is that leadership teams are dominated by a very narrow social identity group, which looks pretty much the same all over the world. So I think that's part of the problem as well.
That's a little bit of a deviation, but we're talking about CEOs and leaders. And one of the things I've seen you speak about or heard you speak about and write about is when CEOs and leaders speak out on contentious social and political issues, which I thought was a really interesting, almost like deviation to some of the things that I would conventionally think about their role. So I think people can get this terribly wrong.
Yeah.
So what's your guidance here for, and we can use the examples that you've researched, but what's your guidance for when CEOs and leaders should speak out and when they shouldn't, and how they make the decision on what side of the line to be on?
I've just written an article, so if people are listening don't want to buy my book, I've just written an article in Harvard Business Review. It's called it's under the big idea. It's called Corporate Advocacy in an Era of Social Outrage. And it talks about this intersection of corporate employee voice. So there's a lot of articles out there saying, when should leaders decide when to speak up, which is the question you've just asked me. There's a lot of articles out there saying, how should companies evolve their organizational culture? I think what is happening is that bottom-up pressures and top-down pressures are meeting each other. And we've started to have the expectation from young employees that they can pressure leaders to represent them politically in some way. So that article has 9 questions for when an organization should decide whether or not to speak up. And I would suggest running through those 9 questions. If any one of them is an answer no, that may be a sign you need to think again. But I mean, I suppose the bigger point would be you need to have a process in place. You need to understand how you're going to make these decisions in real time so you're not backpedaling and reacting to the latest thing that's happened.
Oh, I'll ask you to go through all the 9 questions, but could you just give us a sense, because I want people to read the article. I think that was the article that I was referring to, actually.
Possibly. I mean, does this relate to positions you've already taken? Is this an issue where you can meaningfully make a difference? Have you already ensured that you aren't making this issue worse with your political spending or your business decisions, things like that.
And what about really sensitive issues, like ultra sensitive issues like war, conflicts that are happening in the world?
Abortion, gun control.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many issues that younger people or external stakeholders might expect some organizations, some leaders, irrespective of whether it's directly related to their company or not, because they're an institution of note and they're a leader of that institution. They're expected to have a position on these things. So how would you navigate the pressure to make a comment, to have a statement, to have a point of view with the desire probably not to, or not to get involved, or to be neutral?
Well, I think one of the problems we're having is that neutral middle ground has kind of become a quicksand. I discussed this precise issue with my MBAs relatively recently, because as you will know, after the October 7th tragic attacks, McDonald's had a problem in that its Israeli franchise is speaking up and donating to the IDF. Its Egypt and Oman franchises are funding Palestinian humanitarian organizations. And so, yeah, McDonald's has a problem with what McDonald's says at the corporate level, and even more of a problem because McDonald's is a company that arguably ought to be laser focused on the climate impact of beef, which is its core product. So I think the first thing you need to do is just kind of get employees clear that, you know, McDonald's making a statement on the Middle East conflict is not really going to do anything apart from have a maybe problematic second order consequences. I don't think anybody changed their mind on abortion because of anything that Coca-Cola said, for example. So I think the first thing you need to do is have a conversation internally and get all these points across. And then I think the second thing you need to do is take a human rights centered approach. So let's just dive in and say a human rights-centered approach to reproductive rights would mean that in the US, where we have our healthcare is tied to our jobs, you provide female employees with access to reproductive healthcare. You are not undermining the rights of employees that do not believe that that should be, that should be a right. If you don't want to have access to that care, do not use it. You are not undermining anybody's rights to do it by doing that. The right to health is a human right, and there are no other meaningful options from a human rights perspective.
So we've talked about some of the things that aren't going so well, things that organizations are doing in the difficult subjects that they need to address, and tensions around communicating or not communicating their position on difficult issues. I'm talking more broadly now about being a good business, being a responsible business. Do you have case studies where this is being done well?
I hesitate, but I'm asked this all the time. Who's doing a good job? Who's a good company? And I would say, first of all, no one's doing anything very well. And that very often, if you have a bad reputation on a topic, it may be a sign you're doing a better job than everybody else. So I'm very reluctant to name companies because immediately then people start finger pointing. I have this example in my book where I talk about Patagonia that, you know, gave away ownership of its business to charity. It took literally about 8 hours before people started bitching about how the business model is still dependent on plastic and employees aren't going to get a stake and so on. So we need to understand nothing you ever do will be good enough, which is part of the problem. I do, in my book, use the example of Chobani, which is a private company, so has things easier in some respects. But I think Chobani is not perfect, but it's done a few things that are very, very impressive. One, it has given workers a stake in the business. Two, it is focused on the American food system. It's not a monopoly. It's very, very focused on issues that directly relate to its core product and how it makes money. Most impressively of all, its factories are in Idaho and upstate New York, both very Republican parts of the country. The CEO is Turkish and has an NGO related to refugees. Chobani has hired refugees in these very Republican parts of the country without suffering any of the anti-woke backlash that we hear about every day. And those people have been accepted by the local community. And this has all worked very successfully. And there's a very good culture. So that impresses me.
And what do you think are the ingredients for a healthy culture? So if you're thinking about the case studies that you've seen where this has been done well, without talking about individual companies, What are the characteristics of their culture?
Alignment between stated values and underlying decisions, paying attention to what kind of behavior is rewarded and valorized to be senior leadership, the ability to say what you actually think without feeling you will be penalized or laughed at or canceled, reliability, you know, feeling that your colleagues are reliable and have your best interests at heart. And I would even say these days, now there's so much focus on the individual, meaningful teams with role clarity and an idea that, you know, we need to work for the good of the team. So if you are burnt out and you need to work from home and you don't feel like doing your job today, understanding that there is going to be a burden on other team members and that we nonetheless need to get our work done. I think there has been, you know, there's been this idea of bringing your whole self to work that comes from a very positive place. It's about diversity. It's about psychological safety. But I think we've somewhat lost the idea of professionalism and somewhat lost the idea that you ought to be able to do your job and then go home and be a Satanist in your free time if you'd like to.
They sound like things that are timeless. So you, I could have asked you that question 25 years ago and you probably, you may not have framed it in the same way, but many of the same attributes of a successful organization would have to have those things in place that you just described.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about this for decades. There's a very famous 1994 article about how to build an ethical culture that makes many of these points. But again, we've treated ethical culture as a case of removing bad apples. We remove the bad people. We have policies and procedures and we investigate and we get rid of them. And then we act as if the organization won't have a problem anymore. So there's been a reluctance, I think, to think of culture as a design issue, to think of culture as a serious issue. There's a tendency to treat all this stuff as fluffy rather than incredibly important and fundamental to how the business makes money.
So it seems to me then, maybe I'm oversimplifying this a little bit, and please say so if you think I am. If you think about the ingredients of a good culture, of a good organization, those things that you just described, which are, as I said, sound timeless to me. Is this therefore about the orientation of the organization? So what it is explicitly choosing to do. So ultimately, whether they deal with the issues that we've been talking about so far in this conversation, it's a conscious choice that's built into their strategy and therefore embedded through the activities and through the decisions that they make on a day in, day out basis.
I think that's a wonderful vision and I would agree with it. Let's just not kid ourselves that that's very, very difficult to do in practice. It's very easy to say these things should be embedded into everything we do and every aspect of our culture. I think the devil is in how you actually execute on that.
It is. It is very, very difficult because you have these, you almost in many ways, I think in these organizations, you have the legacy business holding you back. There's an underlying momentum to how organizations operate. And that momentum will be causing issues. Unintended consequences and designed consequences that have been accepted previously that no longer would be tolerated. But in the end, they're part of the fabric of the DNA of that business. So I can see how it's difficult to implement, but so is any organizational change. They're all difficult to implement. It's just a question of what you choose to focus your efforts on changing towards. I mean, organizations today could change to say, I need to become a technology company because I'm worried about artificial intelligence and everything and becoming obsolete. That's a really difficult shift to make.
Yeah.
So I still think it boils down to, and maybe again, I'm going to simplify it, it comes down to choice. Organizations are going to have to transform. They do transform all the time. This is a big transformation, clearly, but it shouldn't be an impossible transformation. Something that organizations are used to doing.
I agree. It is not impossible if you focus on it and want to get it done. I mean, choice is interesting because a corporation does not have a single brain and cannot make choices. An organization is a system that is evolving all the time. And so I used to have a professor that said you don't change culture by trying to change culture. And I think that's a really interesting way to think about it. If you see in companies like Boeing and Wells Fargo, they keep changing their CEOs and it's sort of like the organizational immune system is too good for these CEOs. It's sort of reversed. So you need to look at structures. You need to look at role clarity. You need to look at incentives. You need to look at what kind of behavior gets rewarded, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can't just have, you know, free beer and a chief happiness officer and hope that everything's going to be okay.
Yeah, well, if you do, that means you're not taking it seriously enough because it's not in the core of the organization.
Yes.
So where's this heading? So this has come a long way in the last several decades, as you've described. If you take a 10 to 20 year view from now, where do you envision the future? What do you envision the future to look like?
I mean, I have a hard time with that because I think our political processes are under such threat. There is so much misinformation, disinformation. The progress of technology is very, very rapid. There are lots of reasons to be very, very fearful. I hope that we are nonetheless moving to a more, let's call it a more systemic conversation where we're starting to be serious about, you know, what is the role? I'm sorry about the horns of New York in the background. What is the role of business? What is the role of government? What is the role of civil society? So let's think about, let's think about a very hot topic, which is social media platforms, or maybe even what technology businesses should be doing about artificial intelligence. There are a number of emerging topics. Climate change would be another, where we don't feel like we can leave this to private companies. We don't necessarily trust Facebook to, you know, act in good faith about the social impact of these technologies on our children, on our political process. Nor do we or should we trust the government to regulate and control for these processes. So I think one of the things that we really need to grapple with as a society here is how many of these very complex emerging governance challenges that we're having. I'm not sure I'm super optimistic about whether we're going to solve them or not, but we're certainly not going to solve them if we can't get to the point because there's so much noise and misinformation and kind of bullshit out there, meaning that we can't even have a useful conversation that accepts that not everybody is perfect, but that we have these real systemic challenges we need to get to grips with.
Absolutely. This has been a fascinating, rich conversation. So I genuinely appreciate you taking the time to do this. Do you have a final message that you'd like listeners to take away from our conversation or things that we haven't talked about that you'd like to convey?
Oh, I mean, I think I would kind of just want to close by saying, and I think this is hopefully clear in the whole conversation, I don't have all the answers. I so far from have all the answers, it's not even funny. I've tried to put forth an idea that we need new metaphors for how we think about business. We need to acknowledge that a business is not a self-interested black box. It's a system that sits in other systems. And so I would say that I don't have all the answers, but I think we need to ask better questions. And so I hope if people will join me in asking better questions, that then smarter people than me can come up with some of these better answers.
Thank you. Professor Taylor, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. To support this podcast, please follow us on whatever platform you're using. It makes a huge difference. Thank you again. Hope to see you next time.